national calamity, the great Bharata civil war of those days. In the Mahabharata war, Arjuna is not a mere spectator, but a spirited and accredited leader, fully and entirely involved in it. Due to the terrible crack-up within himself, he suddenly realizes that, in spite of all his proficiency at war, he has no efficiency to take up his bow and arrow and act diligently. He knows that his duty is to lead, to champion the righteous cause of the Pandavas, but he dares not. He realizes that he must annihilate totally the unmitigated philosophy of materialism or the Kauravas, which is an extremely dangerous and pernicious philosophy for the world of peace. But he feels benumbed by his own emotional involvement with the personalities who run the Kaurava government. He looks at the law and the nation-killing actions of his cousins, and yet he sees not the basic immoralities and the lurid vulgarities in them. He is determined to strike, but he dares not to start a war against his own kith and kin. Thus torn between powerful opposing urges in himself, he stands too paralyzed to act, and to a man of action, to vacillate and to hesitate in his own field of activity is worse than death itself. Held thus between the horns of a deep sense of inner dilemma, stretched between two opposite ideals, crushed with a despondency, Arjuna's inner personality gets continuously tossed up and down by his own indecisiveness and hesitation. As a professional psychiatrist would do, Lord Krishna encouragingly allows his patient to talk himself out to a sheer exhaustion. Though the Pandava prince quotes scriptures, talks the language of a non-violent saint, and freely uses the vocabulary of confirmed pacifists, it is fully evident to us that the patient is suffering from his own mental hallucinations under his self-created intellectual conditionings. He is suffering from his own inner hang-ups. Arjuna's judgment of the situation around him goes wrong and wild as his intellect gets more and more agitated and disorganized due to his preoccupations with his own sense of ego and individuality. As a limited egocentric personality, he comes to judge the situation from his own standards and looks at the world around him through a web of his own private and personal relationships. No judgment of the world outside can be enduringly true unless we eliminate from our bosom our selfish ego. By rising above our own ego alone can we correctly discriminate the world of happenings around us from universal standards of values and from righteous ideals of an equally universal norms of vision. This true judgment through right vision is always impossible without surrendering our ego and positively rising above its enslaving shackles. Let us take an example. Very often we hear a father at home or an officer in his department or even a minister in his government seat say that they are compelled to act compromising what they know to be the right due to pressures brought to bear upon them. This is a ready-made statement used as an excuse by many mouths, decently concealing some of its really ugly, extremely stinking, seriously ulcerated implications. Man compromises with his ideals only under the pressures of his own selfish desires and passions for possessing more, for gaining more, and for grabbing more. If one is dedicated to one's duty and determined to sacrifice everything in order to uphold what he believes in, no amount of outside pressure can ever affect such a noble one. Arjuna on the Kurukshetra battlefield evaluates the situation from his own personal ego level. He then recognizes his cousins, uncles, his guru Drona and his grandsire Bhishma, all up in arms and arrayed against him in the Kaurava lines. To destroy them all is, according to Arjuna, a spree of murder of the best in the nation. Such a daring conclusion, self-defeating and suicidal, is fabricated by his own ego to delude him. In a war, it is not the individual that comes to lift his arms against the individual persons in the opposite camp. War is a clash of ideals, not of individuals. A clash of personalities, not of persons. In war, armies win or lose. Ideas live or die. Some unacceptable ideals get maimed and some false values get reshaped. Never do individual soldiers ever commit any murder in the clash of armies. In life also, we find today our youth around the world is miserably failing to rise above their own individuality, to merge with the universal, and to discover their total identity with their ideal. They are too self-centered and preoccupied with their own opinions that they are not able to evaluate all the happenings around them and thus judge the world play that is going on about them. At best, their valuations and judgments are mere whisperings of their own ego, dangerous murmurings of their own passions and prejudices. This maladjustment within brings about the nerve-wracking despairs, all-destroying inefficiencies and unnecessary impotent dejections, meaningless angers and self-deluding disillusionments. How then are we to rise above our natural sense of selfishness, our self-defeating ego-oriented urges? They do certainly color our judgment, distort our vision, belie our discrimination. True. But how to lift ourselves above our own ego and from those selfless heights, bathe in the revealing light of pure knowledge? How can we come to judge rightly and recognize clearly the world around us? The strategy of invoking the higher being of intelligence that lurks in each one of us and of defeating the dark forces of the ego and its dangerous henchmen is the discovery of life chalked out in the Bhagavad Gita.